Response to the Responses. The ninth talk at Gutenberg College's 2013 Summer Institute, How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast, was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 3, 2013. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Modify the format a little bit. I might say a couple of things just to prime the pump, but I think the best thing to do would be to invite you to ask me to respond to whatever parts of the other papers you want me to respond to, mostly because I don't remember the other papers until you remind me. I had reactions as they went, but I don't know that I can just recall them without some prodding, without some help. One thing that does come to mind is that as Toby was talking this morning, he mentioned he was trying to envision the time in America that he thought I was envisioning that was sort of this golden age of Christianity or something, and went back through all the various grievances against us Americans. I don't envision a golden age of Christianity anytime in America. We have to make a distinction between what it would be like to be a genuine, committed, authentic follower of Jesus and how you would live, and on the one hand. And on the other hand, what kind of space is created for forming a society, civilization, if you have a Judeo-Christian worldview as opposed to not having a Judeo-Christian worldview? When I talk about the genius of America and when I talk about what a wonderful experiment it was, I'm not talking about Americans. We have done brutal things. We have done awful things. Right from the beginning, slavery was this incredible moral scar on our nation. I mean, there's no question about that. People have always been people. People, Americans, have always been sinners. And as sinners, they've done horrible, grievous things. I'm not trying to whitewash that and go back and say there used to be a time, what was it, 1946, I think, that there used to be a time where everything was wonderful. No, I mean, even in the wonderful Leave It to Beaver 50s that I grew up in, there was an underbelly that was pretty ugly. So that's always been the case. But what is wonderful about America is, unlike all of the rest of human history, where you were either the king or you were owned by the king and a slave of the king who had the right of life or death over you, there was formed a society and a civilization in this space that got created by a genuine Judeo-Christian worldview that allowed us to form a society among sinners with all of their viciousness toward each other, but a society that supported the possibility of people being individuals and have the freedom to live as individuals and to live with the recognition, whether we followed through with it or not, the recognition that a human being deserved honor and respect from other people and so on. Well, the world had never known such a thing. We were unique. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about the Christian basis for American society. That's what I'm talking about. I have no illusions about us having lived like good Christians. Of course we didn't. So when it looks like, if you remember my chart in the paper, there's only a very small subsection of all those categories that I believe in, and that is radical biblicism, where a person is committed radically to believing the beliefs, the tenets, the worldview, the values of the Bible, and only the Bible. Most people on the political right are not with us, if you are joining me in that radical biblicist. Most of the people on the social and political right, they're not there. And I understand that, but why would I be more likely to be mistaken as a politically right person than a politically left person? Because we share a worldview, roughly. I believe in the God that is, that was propagated through Western history by Christendom. Not exactly the God of that Christendom, because, well, we all know that I'm a heretic, but so not exactly that God for a lot of different reasons, but roughly that's the God that I believe in, a God who's the author of all reality, that is our judge, that is our king, that we are answerable to, and so on. You depart from that worldview, and what kind of civilization and culture are you going to end up with? It's not going to be the kind of civilization and culture that we've got. So take the political left. The political left takes concepts like equality and freedom and runs with them. Well, the founding fathers would be horrified, because the founding documents of America, they did not encode within them the backcloth that every one of them assumed everyone would agree with. And that backcloth was the Judeo-Christian worldview, its values, and its, you know, its basic picture of reality. They assumed that. It didn't make it into the Constitution because they didn't even envision that not being a possibility. And that was the seeds of the destruction of America. Because we're now faced with a time where if you have to respect everyone equally in America just because they're an American citizen, what happens when you get 55% of America believing in fundamentalist Islam that believes we should live by Sharia law? What do we do with that? Do we welcome the outcome as, well, we are respecting their equality as citizens under the law, and we're giving them the freedom to believe that they should kill me? The founding fathers, I don't think, would have approved of that society, not because they don't believe in freedom, because they didn't really believe in equality. They believe that there were boundaries on human behavior that are also implicit in everything that they believed. And those boundaries were created by the Judeo-Christian worldview. Once you strip the Judeo-Christian worldview away, equality and freedom spell destruction. They are not a good thing any longer. So someone like, now I believe that as a radical biblicist. There are a lot of people who believe that because they believe in the Constitution and the traditions of America. They're socially conservative, they're politically conservative, and they recognize that that's all part of the tradition. So they want to preserve that tradition because they too think that civilization, culture cannot survive without it. But they're still not on the same page as I am, because they don't want to bow their knee to Jesus. But I overlap with them in recognizing that what God has done in history in this American experiment, by having a space created by truth, the biblical worldview, that allowed for this incredible experiment in individual freedom that is America, they recognize that is sowing the seeds of its own destruction if we jettison the Judeo-Christian worldview, what they call the traditions of America. I would say it's the Judeo-Christian worldview. So, what are your questions or comments?
Hi, Jack. I have a terminology question that I've been confused about, and I think I can figure out a way to ask this question that will make it really clear for me. The terms are, and I know you've gone over this, but just to clarify for me, contrabiblicism or contrabiblicist, leftist, superior class. I'm kind of wanting a Venn diagram of these particular, you know, what I'm talking about, a category organization. And then the thing that would help me most would be if you could take, I know you don't have a whiteboard, if you could take and put somebody like a environmental rapist, or, you know, the corporate greedy person who is going to have absolutely no support in the superior class, and put him in one of those categories, or out of all those categories, or exactly how you would clear. Could you clear that up? Do you see my question?
Yeah. The set of, as the way I'm envisioning it, the set of all the people who belong to the superior class coincides with the set of all people who are religiously committed to contra-biblicism, leftism. That's one of them you asked me, which is an identical set to leftism. So all of those are an identical set, as I'm
okay, so the person who is the environmental rapist or the greedy corporate person, he's not involved?
He's not in that.
So to clarify, does that person, say the person who is a greedy corporate person, are they against the Bible in some sense? So that's the reason why I'm confused, because it seems like they might be classified as a contra-biblicist in that they are promoting a view of the world which allows them, which is against the Bible, which allows them to do things which one wouldn't want to count as biblical.
That's helpful. When I talk about contra-biblicism, I'm just using that as a title for this religion that is the Orthodox religion of the superior class. There's a lot of people who are not committed to that religion, whose lives are contrary to the Bible in a whole variety of different ways. But they're not people who are seeking status and acceptance and a sense of superiority by being proponents of this religion.
Okay, thanks.
That's how I'm using it. So now, I need to qualify that. I think there are probably plenty of examples of robber barons, corporate robber barons, especially in Hollywood, in the tech thing, that fancy them, that are members of that superior class who believe in contra-biblicism, but they just hide their robber baron activity over here. But it's at the cocktail parties where they really espouse their contra-biblical, they wave their contra-biblical flag. Because it's mostly, it's self-serving and it's social standing that they're seeking. And all you have to do is say the right things and believe the right things and give money to the right causes and that kind of thing to get your creds in the superior class. You can go out and act like a complete capitalist, greedy robber baron. That doesn't matter. You gave to save the whales or whatever.
I think this is probably well trod, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. You just referred to contra-biblicism as a set. And it seems to me that at times you're referring to it as a set. I mean, probably a fuzzy set or something like that. But at other times it seems, when you say that, I think like an extensionalist definition. And then at other times it seems like you go with a more intentionalist definition, whereas it's the motivation to just explicitly adopt the opposite of what the Bible teaches. And that, I think, at least for me, it led to confusion and understanding some of your points. So maybe you could clarify that.
Yeah. A redneck motorcycle gang member who believes he's going to hell, knows he's going to hell, and wants to get there as fast as he can, and doesn't like those, I don't even know what name he has for them, but members of the superior class. He is intentionally going against biblical things, but he's not doing so in order to belong to the set. That's what I have in mind as the person who has committed himself to the religion of contra-biblicism.
Thank you. Second distinction that I think for me would help be helpful, and this came up, I think, several times in the first handful of talks, it's you talk about the good, but it seemed like there was some confusion and you had to clarify often and say, for example, it seemed like you would hold a position. You are in an epistemic position to judge whether or not someone is committed to the good, but you're not in an epistemic position with respect to that the state of that person's soul, their salvation. It seems like that was something that came up a lot in early on, and I think that's important, and I want to just kind of hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, that's a very important distinction. I mean, there's a question of what I believe, what I value, what I claim to be committed to, how that directs my life and my choices on the one hand, and then there's who I am as God is creating in me a heart to want to know him and so on. And that's the messiness of human experience, is those don't always go together very well. You can have people who are not very much committed to the good yet, but who are genuinely seeking God and are genuinely being drawn to God by God's Spirit. that they're children of God, they're destined for the kingdom of God, but as you and I, looking at their impact on society and their contribution to our world and our culture, they're not really promoting the good at this point in time. And that's okay. I mean, it's very important to make a distinction between what is biblical in its content. Growing up, and maybe a lot of you are in the same position, to talk about somebody being a Christian is tantamount to saying whether they're saved or not, whether they're going to get eternal life or not. I make a distinction between those. Or let's make it biblical. I might say somebody is not biblical. That's not passing judgment on their eternal destiny. I have no idea what their eternal destiny is. I'd have to look at the whole trajectory of their life if I were going to make a judgment, and ultimately I'm not their judge anyway. I mean, I'm not the one who has to make that determination. But I can know, even if they are a child of God, destined for the eternal kingdom of God, their words, their actions, their values that I see before me, I can see that they don't conform to the truth taught in the Bible, that it is not biblical. So whenever I talk about something not being biblical, I'm never making a judgment about the condition of their heart and their destiny. I can't do that.
So final thing, and it's the least well-formed, and it may just be silly, and you can just tell me to shut up if it's silly. I want to flip kind of around what you're saying. So it's not the case that because someone doesn't support the good, we ought to draw a conclusion about the state of their soul. Flip it around. So let's say for whatever reason I am convinced, not certain, but I have good reason to believe that someone is not saved. It seems like you are still going to say we are under an obligation to promote the good with respect to that person, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Now, Tim raised some very, very important questions in that regard. Yes, I think it's still, because every human being is under obligation to pursue the good, period. We're born into this world, we're created into this world with an obligation to pursue righteousness as the Creator would define that. So I don't know whether Tim and I are in disagreement on this, but I wouldn't go so far as to say because they are not a believer, they don't believe in God, they don't believe in the Bible, certainly it's not the case that goodness is irrelevant to them, that they have rendered it irrelevant because they're not on the same page as me. But Tim is very accurate to say how we go about broaching the subject and talking with them has to be sensitive and take into account the kinds of arguments we give are only going to get, I mean, aren't going to have much traction if I say, well, the Bible says. That's just not probably going to be the right approach.
Thank you.
A lot of the beginnings of your paper and the middle part that got a lot of play, but I haven't heard discussed a lot of. I was wondering if you could explore maybe some examples of what it would look like, your end conclusion of what we can do, because you kind of have this response part of the paper. So this is the case, and we talked a lot about what is the case. And I'm kind of wondering, okay, we talked about that, and I'm kind of wondering if you could highlight what you're really imagining, what that looks like to live that way. The closest it's come to being explained, understand, is like pockets or little movements, and I'm just kind of wondering if you could highlight some of those points and what that looks like.
Okay. Yeah, I obviously I'm not altogether satisfied. I haven't finished thinking about that. We're going to have to invent that as we go, I think. I was talking to Ken, and Ken was making the point that it is important to see in my paper that I am looking into the future, not into the present. So when some of you have said, you know, I don't think it's that bad. Well, I don't think it's that bad either when I look out the window. But what I'm arguing in the paper is it's not going to stay not that bad. That's what I'm arguing, is that we're on a, you know, we're on a locomotive headed straight off the cliff, and it's going full speed ahead, and no one's going to stop it. And when it gets to falling off the cliff, then things are going to be that bad. So, yes, I'm looking into the future, and I may not even know what I'm talking about, but this is what it looks like to me. So it's now preparing for the future, but what I'm answering is what it might have to look like in the future, not necessarily now. So to be clear about that. We won't live like Amish. I don't think I think the model would be, and I wish we had a whole lot more information about what did it look like to be a believer in the Roman Empire in the first century, first couple centuries. What were their lives like? Because they were faced with exactly the kind of situation that I think we're going to be faced with, although I fear that our situation may actually be worse than theirs was, because Rome maybe ends up being more tolerant than what lies ahead of us. I don't know. But at least there would be some other believers that we could look to and go, help me, we've never been here before. What does it look like to live in this kind of situation? Unfortunately, I don't know where to go for that information. You know, I think that's what the Amish try to do, but that doesn't make any sense to me. Dressing funny and not trying to make yourself conspicuous in the way that they do. I mean, I know they have their own reasons for doing it, but that's not what I'm envisioning. What I envision is being invisible Amish. Amish on the inside and pagans on the outside. I mean that's what I envision, where we know we can see one another's shared values and can base a community on that invisible bond that exists between us, our spiritual bond that exists between us. But I don't think there's anything to be gained by trying to wear it on our, you know, in our clothing and wear it on the surface. But otherwise, the fact that we support one another, encourage one another, I mean, it seems to me that the whole value of Christian community is when life comes at me, I can get really awfully confused. Life can throw dust in my eyes. And I may need to borrow your eyes sometimes in order to see reality. I may need to say to you, I don't get it. Tell me what's out there. What am I not getting? What am I not seeing? And that's where we need each other. So to live in community in that sense, I think, is absolutely critical. And that will mean probably forming networks. I mean, I applaud what Tim was saying in that regard. That's exactly what I think we're headed toward. We can't save America, so we save ourselves by forming communities where we can support one another in that journey. Now, it's not a very adequate answer, but I mention the biggies, I think. We are so messed up in our concept of sexuality. We have to do a lot better job of thinking through, talking about, figuring out what it means to be a sexual being, as a human being. We've got a lot more talking to do about that. So we should become very proactive in clarifying that. And then just education generally is what I mentioned in the paper. Nancy was telling me about niece in public school, where the teacher said to her, "You don't want Romney for president. He loves rapists." Now, regardless of what you think of Romney, he doesn't love rapists. That is clearly propaganda. And I just think anymore, our kids went to public school. I'm not an anti-public school person. But today, I would not send my children to public school because I think our culture has changed that much. It has changed so much that I don't think there's anything going on there except propaganda. So why would we as a community who believe in the biblical worldview, why would we send our kids to be propagandized into a contra-biblical, hostile to God worldview? That doesn't make any sense to me.
I wanted to quickly say also that I, on a completely subjective experiential level, want to mention that it feels a lot like my train's already off the edge. And I wanted to say thank you, because I found the end clarity points that you made in your paper that you just brought up to be very dust removing. And I just think it is very dust removing, like a duster. I found it to actually, it was ironic that you would explain it in that fashion, because I had a very similar experience with the end tenements of your paper, and I really appreciated those very much. I think it is very obvious that I'm constantly in the world, and it was just helpful to be reminded of those things. So I think that you're probably right about that, because that was seemingly my experience.
It seems like some of the, I'm trying to come to terms with the essence of the main issues in the conference. And one of them, I've concluded, is, are we doing, Toby's talking about we're having a culture war. And that seemed to be less significant than what you said was what you believe is happening. It's more than just a culture war, which I think of as kind of epitomized in that song, in days gone by, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now heaven knows anything goes, that we've got styles, you know, architecture and clothes and food and everything goes in and out of fashion. But we've got a situation here where it's more than we're just building, tearing down buildings whose fashion, who's no longer in fashion, and then building other buildings that are now in fashion, that we're actually doing demolition with nukes. And although we don't realize it, we think we're just doing demolitions like we always did demolition. And the ground that we have cleared with our nuke, in the process of clearing the ground, we've also poisoned the ground. We are removing the ability to build anymore. We've killed the architects. We've ruined the plans. We've ruined the history. So that's the essence of the of what at least one of the things we're asking about is this merely another culture war where things go in and out of fashion and that kind of thing, or is this something where we're making decisions that we're not going to be able to go back from? So I ask your indulgence here. I'm going to read Nietzsche's Parable of the Madman because I think you are the madman. He says, "Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours and ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, 'I seek God, I seek God'? As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. 'Had he got lost?' asked one. 'Did he lose his way like a child?' asked another. 'Is he hiding, or is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage, emigrated?' Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. 'Whither is God?' he cried. 'I will tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any way, any up or down? Are we not straying as though an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing on us? Do we not need to light lanterns in the morning?' As he had. 'Do we hear nothing as yet of the noise of the gravediggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? God's too decompose. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement? What sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed, and whoever is born after us, for the sake of this deed, he will belong to a higher history than all history hitherto.' Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground, and it broke into pieces and went out. 'I have come too early,' he said to them. 'My time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on the way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves.'" It has been related further that on the same day the madman forced his way into several churches and there struck up his Requiem Aeternum Deo. Led out and called to account, he is said always to have replied nothing but, "What, after all, are these churches now if they are not the tombs and sepulchres of God?" So you are the madman. You have come too soon.
Just to make sure I'm clear, Jack just got compared to Nietzsche.
No, it's the madman.
I'm not sure my remarks are completely on the subject, but I they've been resonating in my head all afternoon, so I just got to say them. And partly it's just a very simple taking a look at the title of the institute, or title of the paper, "How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast." And I found myself thinking all afternoon, it's in the "when you cannot kill the beast" portion of that phrase that everything gets speculative, messy. When we try to probe ahead and try to probe into our mortality, our lives on this earth, and then everybody has an answer, everybody has a point of view. And I'm thinking, what do we all share in common? We're all humans, so that's what we share in common. What is a human? A human is a limited creature, limited in every way. It can only be in one place at one time, I guess, you know. We're limited in everything we think about, say, imagine. There is no way that we're in any way like God in his unlimitedness, his completeness in himself. So with that in mind, this is the part that sounds off the subject, because it sounds like I'm requesting you to answer in sort of a pastoral way almost. But I found myself thinking, what about if we focused for at least a minute on the phrase, how do we follow Jesus? And we leave off the second phrase. And then if we enunciate it a little differently and we say, how do we follow Jesus? And you've been thinking a lot about John 15 and the fact that we have said in this institute, Jesus is the King now. He's the coming King in physical reality. If we are his subjects and his brothers, if he is the King and we owe him everything and complete allegiance, as has been said over and over again, in the midst of all this messy speculative stuff that limited human beings can only get so far with, what is the simplest way of describing following Jesus? Not following Jesus, because we've already said it's Jesus that we want to follow. So we've identified the object or the person to whom we want to follow. But how do we do the following? How do we be followers?
By the very meaning of that term in the New Testament, to follow is to accept Jesus as a rabbi and learn from him, sit at his feet. He is going to teach us about God, about ourselves, about himself, our relationship to him, and so on. So it's engaging with the utmost seriousness with what Jesus taught us about all those things. Now that, of course, involves that's not just a head game. It's not just doing Bible study or doing theology. When I say with the utmost seriousness, I mean hearing what it is that Jesus has to tell us about God and Jesus and ourselves, taking it to heart, and making my whole life answer to that truth in what I choose, in what I think, in what I do. And I think that's what it means to follow him. And that's maybe the trick of the paper is, I mean, the fact of the matter is, how to follow Jesus when you cannot kill the beast would be exactly the same answer to how to follow Jesus when you can kill the beast, which would be exactly the same answer to how to follow Jesus if you don't give a damn about the beast. I mean, it's still the same. To follow Jesus is still, those five things that I highlighted are some of the most important things that we in our present age need to take to heart, I think. So that part is not going to change depending on how we see the future. It ends up being we have to live the same way anyway. What changes, and I've said this a couple times, for me, what change is in my expectations. And in a way, it's kind of strangely comforting. I mean, because otherwise, we as Christians live with a kind of a burden on our shoulders. Be a good enough Christian so that you can be salt and light, and you can change the people around you, and you can change America, and you can save America. Well, I've tried that, and nobody's listening. You know, it's not working. America's not changing. Is that my fault? And that's what I say. It's strangely comforting to realize this isn't my fault. America's right on script. This was meant to happen. It always was going to happen. There's nothing anybody could have done to change it. I just live in the circumstances that I live in now. By the sovereign purpose of God, I am where I am. So what am I going to do about it?
So would
with courage?
Would the the experience of someone like Jeremiah be similar?
Yes, absolutely.
He kept saying the oracle that God had given him over and over again. He never got listened to.
Yeah.
And he ended up in Egypt, you know, in anonymity.
Yeah. In an earlier discussion today, the issue came up. If there's any passion in what I'm, any urgency and passion, where is that coming from? I think it's coming from, I grieve that my children and my grandchildren are not going to have the space that I have. Now, that's God's fault, and I have to accept on their behalf, I have to accept from the hand of God what God has dealt. I was actually going to connect to a point. I lost it.
Sam can help you.
Well, I just want to say that the seminar has significantly raised my level of grief, my level of angst, concern for our grandchildren. I mean, there's a lot of pain in that. There's suffering. I mean, having the clarity that you all have and being able to engage with that clarity is incredibly helpful, but it's also very painful. And what's been running through my mind, and I just wanted to share this, is all day long, what's been going through my mind is what Paul said when he said, these momentary light afflictions are producing for us an eternal weight of glory. And that just, I just keep going back to that. Okay, I don't understand this. I don't know how to relate to my homosexual friends. I don't know how to relate to my grandson who's just isolated himself and come out gay. And it's bewildering. But I guess I go back to that phrase and Habakkuk. Even though the olive tree doesn't bear, yet I will trust in my God. Over and over and over, Habakkuk said, yet again. If this happens, yet again. And I keep thinking, that's a pretty big yet. I better take it seriously. And I don't know. That's where my heart is right now. Hurting, but recognizing that God is producing something that's beyond my ability to even express.
You identifying grief as one of the main themes of your paper is so useful for me to hear you say, because I had mistook grief for a sort of abandonment. I mistook grief and also kind of like almost a selfish sort of disappointment, like, shucks, this didn't go my way. Like, I guess I'm out of here. Like, I mean, there's a parable, it's in Albert Camus' The Plague. It's the second sermon that Father Panlou gives, where during the plague he mentions this bishop who's attending to the sick, and then when he grows weary, he retreats from this plague-ridden town, and he barricades himself in his chapel, and he stays there, and the people in the town come to his chapel, and they throw the dead bodies of their relatives over the wall until he gets sick too. I kept thinking that as I read your thing. I kept thinking, there's no way he's saying that. Like, right. There's no way he's asking us to citadel ourselves and retreat in that way. And when you say grief, I finally grasp the mourning of your paper, the grief of your paper. Why, what you're mourning, and the reason why I couldn't is because we have never had that. Like, you're describing, I wouldn't say golden age, but you're describing experience that we have grown accustomed to the trauma you're describing, and we're specifically grown accustomed to it on both sides. Some of us, not all of us, but generally. But we've endured the persecution from both sides, especially we who just ask too many damn questions, for lack of a better phrase. So grasping onto the concept of grief for you is really, really useful. Maybe you could have led with that, opposed to the left thing, which freaked me out. Because again, we'll talk about that later. I won't waste time with that. So that's very useful. I still, being amongst my generation, and you're right, not knowing what to grieve, not knowing the life that was never there for us, I still feel remarkably hopeful, as anyone would who is young and who is capable of dialogue with their contemporaries. And I know that when, you know, I've matured in this mortal coil, I will have a sort of different opinion about what I was doing in this era, who I was, and how much possibly I could have understood my contemporaries, or how if I really did understand them. But the grief makes me understand that you're not leaving us. Like, because that would have been confusing. Like, because to say we as evangelicals cannot get the job done, I'm out of here. And even the talk that you want to do of, like, the small social groups, like, it still feels a little too, there's still so much good news to say. And the confusion I see is confusion. And we never had a clarity, and there was never a passed down tradition of virtues and morality, and we don't know what makes a good marriage work. We just have no clue. But those of us who are sanctified, and we'll find each other, I think you'd agree, and I get that even though I'm perplexed, it's, even though maybe it's just language, it's the very minor, because I with Eric, I agree, your final sections were remarkably perfect. Your understanding of intellectual commitments to the Bible opposed to a spiritual, opposed to a religious commitment to the Bible. These things are the cornerstone of my faith too, like mostly because I was at school and you told me how to do them. So my language is your language, but then when we got into Revelations, the contrabiblicism and the left and the lack of emphasis on how much I experience. I mean, of course, you didn't write about the superior religious class on the right. You didn't experience a lot of bad stuff from them. Like, you kind of, not that I'm saying you dropped the ball, but where there were holes in your curriculum, they were generational holes. They were experiential holes. Like, because like my wife, I thought, really articulately said, like, we experienced remarkable persecution being Christians with questions during the culture war because we were just supposed to toe the line. Like, we weren't talking about, I mean, I remember at the age of 5, and one of the most defining, I mean, you talk about something that happens to you and then it just plays itself out repeatedly. And my mother was taking me to church and I was wearing one of those little boy blazers. I must have been like 5. And this is also about the time when I figured all sorts of stuff out about sex that I should have never figured out. So at the age of 5, I'm going to church. I'm also in this other area of my life figuring all sorts of stuff about sex that I should, I mean, 5, figuring all sorts of stuff out. And I'm walking up to church and I go, why am I wearing this blazer? And my mom goes, because we're going to church. And I'm like, well, let me rephrase the question. No, I wasn't really this articulate. But my rephrased question was, why does God care that I'm wearing a blazer? And my mom, who has a softer hand than the society, we went to Grace Community, the big mega church down in Cali, and my dad was a deacon important person there, and it was just, maybe I just have a PK experience, but it was brutal. Like, brutal. Like, the kinds of hoops I knew I socially had to jump through so as to not embarrass my family, so as not to embarrass me, so not to embarrass my God, all these things were just hammered home. And then I balk at you sitting at that table saying, I've had generally pleasant experience with evangelicals. I'm like, he's not lying. Like, you've had generally experience. Okay. So, and that's the luxury that maybe that you experienced was you had pleasant experience with evangelicals. And I had pleasant experience with the guys on my football team. Like, cause they got what I was about, which was football. And granted, that was shallow, but that was my first and probably most defining element of fraternity until I got to Gutenberg, was my football team. And those guys were scumbags. I mean, in the sense of, like, really great guys to party with. Like, so, though that dynamic of you highlighting grief is so ultimately the key emotional tone, because I still feel hopeful. I still talk to people and they seem sort of polite. I can still bring up specific elements of the Bible and I sound semi-intelligent and they seem to listen. Now, you're right. If I broached the subject after I said some parable and said, and you better believe in the Bible, they would look like I'd grown a horn out of my head. Like, because that's not how we broach subject matter. And again, this is a little bit of a difference. Like, in the same way that there's a tendency, because America has changed, we're looking at kind of a certain maturity that used to take place between 15 and 25, now takes place between 22 and 32. Like how there's a sort of arrested development that comes about because we don't have a lot to commit ourselves to, so we don't actually, we're not, self-definition is not as required as early as it was once in America. There's a sort of fluidity, there's a sort of wiggle room that we have. Whether it's good or not, it's there. So understanding those differences, I still think we can bring God up. I still think it's our job to bring God up. And I still think if we understand our culture and understand who we're talking to and why they're repelled or they find certain religious ideas repellent, then we can address those ideas as they're hearing them. And to bring up God in a situation where a friend of yours is having an abortion could be the right thing depending on the friend, but also they could hear the 30 years of cultural experience they have with a Christianity that has not been kind to them in certain areas. So the grief thing, thank you for the grief thing. I was going to come up with a question, but I'm pretty sure I forgot it somewhere in there. But thanks for being my teacher, blah, blah, blah. Grief. Makes sense.
Toby did remind me of one difference between what I was trying to say and the way Toby interpreted it. What I'm saying is it's not possible for there to be a superior class of the right and a superior class of the left. Now, the phenomenon you described is right, but I wouldn't categorize them as the superior class, because the way I'm understanding it, back to Chris's question, you've got a superior class that is, they are the superior people. There's a whole pushback against that. I mean, you have traditionalists in the heartland of America who don't think very well of the superior class, and they can reinforce one another in their beliefs and so on. But everybody knows, including them, that they are the underdogs. That to be a traditionalist in America is to be inferior. It's to be a hick. It's to be unintelligent. It's to be narrow-minded. It's to be morally deformed. I mean, there's all kinds of problems with you if you're one of those people. Now, in pushing back, they will support one another and lock arms with one another, and you'll see the phenomenon that you're describing, where if you don't come completely on board, they'll punish you and ostracize you. So, I mean, that's just being human. That's a human dynamic anywhere. What I'm describing is more subtle than that, and that is we have given to us that all of us, I think at some level, all of us recognize that the really, really with it people only accept this kind of person. And so that's why I say there's only the superior class of the left, because as it happens, to get creds in that class takes leftist social political ideas. They don't accept right-wing social political ideas. A traditionalist will not get any traction in that superior class. That's the phenomenon I'm trying to describe, which doesn't detract from the reality of the phenomenon that you were describing, but I'm not using my categories that way. So let me just end with a passionate appeal. Ron mentioned in his paper how much he hates the political conflict. And even though my paper is not primarily about politics, it's about what I think are the spiritual landscape that we're in. Yes, it did touch upon politics, and it was inevitable that it was going to go there. But I would like to suggest that the reason Ron hates politics, as so many of us do, is because mostly we make religious commitments to our political viewpoints. And because we make religious commitments, if you have contrary religious commitments, it is ugly to try to carry on a conversation. There is no dialogue. There's no dispassionate discussion. We are afraid. We are threatened. We are smashing one another's idols, and we get fearful and threatened when we smash one another's idols. I mean, I remember as a kid, raised in Christianity, having a religious commitment to Christianity, when anyone came along and gave counter evidence to my faith, I had a visceral reaction to it. I panicked. And then whenever you panic, all kinds of ugly stuff comes out, and you call one another names, and you intimidate one another, and all kinds of ugly stuff happens. But see, that should be our tip-off. The fact that we can't talk about political issues like that should be the tip-off that we have the wrong kind of commitment to our political beliefs. We have a religious commitment to our political beliefs. Otherwise, we should be able to have a healthy dialogue about them. And if I had just one thing to say to the younger generation, you may be right and we may be wrong in some of your perspectives, but I would just urge you to consider the possibility that it's not merely your experience that has led you to have the perspective, but you have been steered by propaganda to take the perspective that you have taken out of, in conjunction with your experience. And all I can say as an older person, from where I sit, it looks like propaganda is shaping our world. And I hope you will consider the possibility that you have not been immune from being affected by that. And I know you'll even think that I'm making a political comment there, but I'm not. I mean, from my perspective, this is not about politics. I could care less which party wins. I want to pave the way for Jesus to be king, not some Democrat or Republican. Yeah. Thank you all for coming. This has been, from my perspective, the most provocative Summer Institute we've ever had. And I hope it's given you food for thought and that you'll stay with it and keep talking and that we can all grow. Let me pray. Father, we need you desperately in this time of utter confusion and chaos and with forces more powerful than we are, more powerful than our own minds, more powerful than our own hearts, that we are completely at your mercy. If you do not keep us, we will be lost. And so we appeal to you to make us yours, make us people who want to serve you and know you and love you and follow you. And we ask you, beg you for that mercy in the days ahead. In Jesus' name, amen.